This hour of the Jason Rand Show brought to you by Robbins & Company Structural Moving and Foundation Repair. Lots of news happening all around the world and right here at home. Producer Darren, let's find out what's trending.
What's trending in Seattle?
So we have a gang violence problem in Seattle. That's not in dispute. We have an unacceptably high number of people killing themselves, also not in dispute. And yet Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin is pushing legislation that does absolutely nothing to go after those problems in any meaningful way. Instead, she ends up now pushing legislation that ends up trying to criminalize gun ownership, trying to put even more of a burden on enjoying your Second Amendment rights. Because that's really what the goal of this kind of legislation is. It was announced yesterday. It's a series of different laws we'll go over in a moment. But understand the purpose of laws like this. It's to make gun ownership as onerous as possible. Why? Because they think that means you will be less likely to go ahead and purchase a weapon. Whether you're doing it for sport, whether you're doing it for protection, or whether you're doing it because, you know what, you want to. You don't need a reason. They want to make it as onerous as possible, which is a weird tactic for progressives to use because they get very upset, justifiably so, when they complain about laws that make it onerous for women to get abortions. We have that right. You should not get in our way. Okay. Why are you doing it with gun ownership? How weird is that? When it comes to voting, voter ID laws get in the way of you enjoying your constitutional rights to go ahead and have your voice heard and vote in elections. But when it comes to gun ownership, we should make it as hard as humanly possible for you to enjoy that right, because the left doesn't like that right. The left is not a fan of the Second Amendment, and rather than actually have the guts to try to amend the Constitution, repeal the Second Amendment, they do things like this. Jenny Durkin claims, with Congress in the grip of the D.C. gun lobby and too many state legislatures failing to act, our cities must lead the way, and we must all continue to demand action that saves lives. Only she's not saving anyone's life. In fact, arguably, she could be putting some people's lives on the line. Because when you look at some of these proposals that she's sending to the council, which I have to assume is going to be quickly pushed into law, they have a safe storage component. And I think the first two points here are really important. Safe storage. Guns should be stored in a locked container and rendered as unusable to any person other than the owner or authorized user. I don't know how that makes any sense. How do you render it as unusable to someone other than the owner or authorized user? So I'm just kind of curious. Let's say you're a family. Let's say you're a husband and a wife. You've got some kids. And someone breaks into the home. The husband bought the gun. He's the gun owner officially. But he happens to not be home at the time of this break-in. This break-in by a criminal who wants to not just rob the place, but the criminal has a gun. He's likely to use it against this woman and child. Let's give him four kids. Let's bring up the drama a little bit. So you mean to tell me that if the wife, who is not an authorized user of the gun because they're not the owner, uses that weapon to protect themselves, she's a criminal now? And then I love this part. The chief of police will have 1 year to conduct a survey to determine levels of compliance. How do you determine whether or not a gun owner is storing their gun in a locked container and rendering it as unusable to any person other than the owner or authorized user? How do you determine whether or not they're complying with that law? You're either telling me that that's just this nonsense, you're not actually going to determine the levels of compliance, or you're going into homes and searching homes and making sure the guns are properly stored. That's the only way that you can actually determine the level of compliance if you're requiring people to put a gun in a locked container. That's right. How else do you do it? I suppose you could say, we're just doing an informal survey because we heard that you own a gun. Can you tell us whether or not you're properly storing your weapon in a locked container? Answer me. I'm just kind of curious. And if you want to send me a text message, because this seems to indicate that the intent of this bill is to gain access into your home, to search your home, to make sure that your guns are properly stored. 1-800-465-8770. That's our None Better Tax Resolution Hotline. 1-800-465-8770. You've got a whole host of issues here. They say in this law, if a civil case results from a minor, at-risk, or prohibited person accessing a gun, it will be prima facie evidence, meaning fact unless proven otherwise, that the owner is negligent. So now, under this law, you are not presumed innocent. You're presumed guilty. You go into court, if they charge you with this, in Seattle, you go into court assuming that the owner is negligent unless the owner proves otherwise. That's not problematic to anybody. No one out there has just a little bit of concern. We go about our days demonizing guns. Let's be clear. There are many, many, many examples of good people using guns to go after bad people using guns. In fact, it happened yesterday in Oklahoma because it was a good guy with a gun who took out a would-be mass shooter. A bad guy walks into a restaurant in Oklahoma, shoots two people, injures four, and an armed passerby notices, confronts the shooter, and kills him. Here's police captain Bo Matthews.
Can you remind us who shot the suspect and anything about him?
No, we don't know anything other than it was a civilian that was outside and he confronted the suspect and he shot and killed him.
With a handgun?
With a handgun.
Imagine just for a second, just for a second, and I don't want to confuse too many stories in one particular segment, but imagine for a second we had trained good guys with guns at schools protecting innocent civilians, innocent children, innocent staff members from bad guys with guns. Because we have just a passerby whose training I have no understanding of yet. No one does. And he ends up saving a whole bunch of lives. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending at the movies?
A brand new Star Wars film is out, and it gives you the backstory of Han Solo. It's called Solo, a Star Wars story, and it's not good. This is not a good movie. The story explains how Han Solo and Chewbacca became partners, and it has everything to do with the fact that they were joined together, kind of by accident, before they officially joined the actual rebellion.
What's going on?
To divert auxiliary power to the rear deflector shield.
We definitely do.
When do you know how to fly? 190 years old? You look great.
Chewie, get in. All hell bended.
Yeah, so the problem is, unfortunately, Solo is boring. And I think it's a little bit bizarre for me to say this, but it lacks personality, which seems really hard for a Star Wars movie to do. Now, I've seen some of the reviews that are blaming the lead actor. His name is Alden Ehrenreich, or Ehrenreich. He's not the problem with the movie. It's not his fault. He doesn't have anything interesting to do. That's the fault of the writers and the directors. This whole film really drags on and on and on. The last 30 minutes, I think, are really good, but that's only because they're doing the final battle scenes, and even they aren't spectacular. Just in the context of the full movie, it's probably the best. I think the problem with the filmmakers, they overestimated how satisfied we'll all be by seeing all of these characters for the very first time. You've got younger actors obviously playing some very iconic roles, like Harrison Ford's Han Solo, played by Alden. Then, of course, you've got the introduction of Chewbacca, and I think that's really interesting, and I do think it's effective. Danny Glover plays Lando. I think he does it relatively well.
There's no liars in this, just players.
The seat taken.
Nobody's in the seat, then you take it, son.
So this is, it's the back?
It's the back.
Back. Got it.
You played before?
A couple times, yeah.
Captain Lando Calrissian.
Han Solo.
Looks like you're having a good day.
I'm a lucky guy.
So boring.
Can I ask you a question, Captain Calrissian?
Anything, Han.
It's Han, but that's okay. I heard a story about you. I was wondering if it's true.
Everything you've heard about me, It's true.
Okay. Unfortunately, those types of scenes and those introductions and what you think will be satisfying, they're not satisfying enough. Because even those scenes, and I particularly pulled that one on purpose because it just drags on. And I have to say this, as much as I love Woody Harrelson and Paul Bettany, who are both in this movie, can we not hire people who aren't in every other film? We just saw Paul Bettany in The Avengers. You've got Woody Harrelson in Three Billboards. He seems to be the actor du jour. Can we get someone else? Can we get other people who aren't so oversaturated? Solo is out now. It is appropriate for kids and family members. It's just, I don't recommend it because it's kind of a snooze fest. I'd love to find out if you plan on seeing this weekend. Send me a text on the Numb Better Tax Resolution Hotline, 1-800-465-8770. That's 1-800-465-8770. Solo is out now. However, I do not recommend it. Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to the Jason Rance Show. Yeah, let's talk about it. We're live in the Online Trading Academy studio. Working Washington, the labor union front group, they sent out a tweet that I'm kind of proud of. Not because the content is stupid, but I'm the headliner in what they call a new hate-mongering alliance. I'm the lead name.
Oh, I see what you mean by headliner.
Yeah, like I lead the list.
Top, the number one on the call sheet of hate.
I'm the number one hate monger, according to Working Washington, which hides the fact that they're a labor front union group. Jason, they're good at condemning stuff. Doesn't this new hate mongering alliance of Jason Rance, Amazon, Roger Valdez, who's on the show next, Vulcan, Dory Monson, Dix Driven, and Safe Seattle deserve condemnation too? I don't even know the context of the tweet.
So this is the specific to the hate or the head tax, I mean.
Yeah.
Okay.
They first started by calling out an editorial by the Seattle Times and wondered why the Times isn't doing something or other. I'm number one. I like that. Thank you, Working Washington. I really appreciate it. There's something about the fact that you can't sleep at night angry over positions I take that really, it kind of keeps me going. It's like when you say you believe in fairies and Tinkerbell stays alive. Like, this is what fuels me. Angering Sage Wilson over at Working Washington.
Triggering the libs?
Well, triggering these idiots, yeah. Not liberals in general. I could care less if a liberal doesn't like what it is I have to say, because I don't necessarily care that they hold positions that are different than mine. But these people, the ones who get obsessed with me, there's some humor in that. Speaking of the head tax, Phoenix, the city of Phoenix, is actually pushing really, really hard to lure Seattle businesses to come over there. They're saying, hey, you should relocate with us. It's much cheaper to live and operate. And by the way, we are way more business friendly than the city of Seattle. Look at what they just did, passing a $275 per employee head tax. Chris Camacho of the Greater Phoenix Economic Council told King 5 that the main message to Seattle companies is how they can work with government instead of being targeted by government, and he's already in discussion with some companies.
You have reached out to us already and we're under non-disclosure with, and others, after this, I believe, will begin their search and an evaluation.
Why might they want to leave?
Their concern is primarily about the unknown future related to the operating costs, how they can work with government as opposed to being targeted by government.
Now, I don't know if this was timed exactly to correspond with the story. Yesterday, Amazon announced that they're moving about 130 jobs out of Seattle into Phoenix. It has something specifically to do with the support staff around, I believe, the Amazon restaurant deliveries and the Prime delivery. They're moving 130 jobs out of the city of Seattle and relocating them to Phoenix. That's interesting. Although John Scholes, the president of the Downtown Seattle Association, also talking with King 5, says, we knew that this was going to happen.
I'm not surprised. Seattle's got great fundamentals, but policies like what we've seen out of City Hall can quickly screw that up and send jobs and investment elsewhere.
And of course, you've got council members like Teresa Mosqueda, who says, relax, businesses are just freaking out. They freaked out when they raised the minimum wage, And they're freaking out now.
The sky did not fall.
We have put forward a modest tax that allows for us to ask the biggest businesses to contribute just 14 cents an hour.
It's almost like if you keep saying modest, people will start believing that. No one believes that. No one believes it. And this whole idea that the sky isn't falling. First of all, I didn't say the sky was falling. I made some very significant but simple predictions. You know what I said? I said that they would probably cut hours for certain employees, likely the ones who are the lowest wage income earners. And that's exactly what happened. The UW study commissioned by the city of Seattle said lower wage workers lost an average of $125 a month. It hits more in certain industries than others, particularly the restaurant and services industry. Now, all the studies are not done. It's disingenuous of either side to say we have any idea what's happening. The full minimum wage across the board for everybody isn't even fully in effect. Not even for a full year. So we don't know the long-term impacts. The short-term impacts, however, have been negative. And you can pretend all you want that that data doesn't exist. But it does, and the people who know that it exists are the people who are impacted by it every day. Just a real quick update. Remember we had Dan Austin, he's the owner of Peel & Press. He is the restaurant that was targeted for a boycott by folks who are upset that he wants a referendum to repeal the head tax. They tried to boycott him. He posted this on his Facebook page last night. Past and present restaurant friends, anybody want to help seat people and drop menus at my restaurant tonight? We are getting crushed with positive support around the attempted boycott. Good for him. Good for you for supporting people like this. And by the way, that doesn't bode well for the forces out there who think that this referendum isn't going to make it to the ballot. You're listening to The Jason Rance Show. Welcome back to the Jason Rance Show on AM 770, KTTH, and 94.5 FM of the Greater East Side. In Forbes this week, Director of Seattle for Growth, Roger Valdez, reported Councilmember Lorena Gonzalez voted on the job-killing head tax, informed at least in part by a report he says doesn't exist. But as I reported on KTTH.com and on the show yesterday, the report does exist. I have it on my desk. I've seen the emails from the consulting firm McKinsey with the actual study, though as I pointed out yesterday, the email that was forwarded to me with the actual document is missing time and date data, seemingly deleted before they actually forwarded it to me. So I've asked the council to explain this, still waiting on an answer. But Roger Valdez does not agree with my assessment, and he joins me now. Good morning, Roger. Thanks for coming on.
Hi. How are you?
I'm doing well. So you wrote in the original Forbes piece, and it's still up. We've got it up on our blog at ktth.com. You said, there was never a report. City leaders were citing a report that never existed, reported as fact by reporters that never verified its existence to justify a tax on jobs. Now, I think that that is wrong based upon the context of how they refer to the report. I've got my piece up at ktth.com. Tell me why I'm wrong.
Okay, sure. And thanks for the time. So the distinction is between a briefing, you know, a PowerPoint that was shared with four of the council members that were supportive of this, Mosqueda, O'Brien, Gonzalez, and Herbold. And McKinsey went in and briefed those folks, and they were using materials, including this PowerPoint, right? This PowerPoint was available to those four individuals, and then only towards the end, based on documents I disclosed from the council, only at the end was that report sent to some staff. And that document was not an official sort of report that mm-hmm. was notated and had an executive summary and all that good stuff that reports usually have. It was actually called Some Facts About Homelessness in King County in Seattle. It was more of a briefing document. And even the bullet that's about what it would take to solve the problem or how much are you spending refers mainly to the increase in the prevalence of homelessness compared to the amount of money that's being spent on it. And there's a bullet that says you really ought to be spending more like 360 to 400 million or something. But that wasn't to solve homelessness, okay? So everybody, when Gonzalez mentioned, I read this report, or saw it in the Times, which whoever you believe, the Times says she saw the details of the report in the Seattle Times. She says the report was this PowerPoint. When everybody was in town hearing $400 million, they were all asking, where's the report?
Mm-hmm.
And nobody had an answer, and not even the press had a report. And finally, we got, we did find the PowerPoint. Someone at the Puget Sound Business Journal had it. But this was after the vote was taken already. And then we received information from McKinsey saying, hey, we're working on the report right now. That was on the 17th, 3 days after the final passage of the legislation. So I draw a distinction between the briefing they had, which is real, and a report that actually goes through, lays out methodology and says, here's how we came to a conclusion. And so I think it's an important distinction. And also, no one had access to the PowerPoint. You didn't, I didn't, the press didn't. It was a document behind the scenes that was influencing the decisions, but no one had a chance to vet any of that.
Yeah, they kept it a secret.
That's the problem.
Yeah, and I don't disagree with that. And I question whether or not the details even in this PowerPoint are accurate. They seem a little wonky to me. They seem a little out there. And I will join you in getting upset with the council and how they keep a lot of this a secret. They're not quick to respond to any of our requests, nor would they be to yours. But you flat Correct. Out said that the report did not exist, and that was sort of the big gotcha moment of your article. And it's a false point. Had you said,
hold on, because
I would argue that if you said that the PowerPoint is not a report, that it should not be considered a report, I would 100% agree with you. But the council clearly counted, and McKinsey itself, and the email of this I have up online, the email responds to the PowerPoint, refers to the PowerPoint as the report. And so I think it's technically true that Lorena Gonzalez, however disingenuous she might be in the long run, and I think she is, when she said she was basing it on a report, she got the report, technically speaking.
So there's a semantic issue about, the file of the PowerPoint is called final report. And so the question I would have for you and anybody that's questioning this is, why did McKinsey bother to issue a report and tell us, hey, we're working on the report? Why didn't they just send us the PowerPoint? If that was the report, they would have just sent us that.
I think they're likely multiple reports, right? I mean, I think you and I think agree that there's going to be another more traditional report, right?
Well,
at least that's my expectation.
Well, my point is, Jason, that you had an individual on the council saying, I saw a report that said we should spend $400 million a year. Number one, nobody had access to that report. Number two, when that document that she was calling a report did emerge, it didn't have a recommendation to spend $400 million. It had a bullet point about how much we're spending compared to the rate of homelessness, and it didn't say to solve the problem, spend $400 million. It wasn't until later that you got the full report on the 18th that you actually saw McKinsey saying, here's some recommendations, mm-hmm. Et cetera, about where we, how we
because
did
they had
methodolo-
a, they had a meeting. They had a meeting apparently on May 11th, and I'm still trying to confirm that detail. And again, the council is not being very forthcoming with this information.
Well,
they're a little bit slow.
The committee at 9 o'clock, and one of the council staff was asking for the report at 7:44 a.m. saying, where's the report? We would have liked to have seen it before the Times reported on it. Where is it? And at that time, they had the PowerPoint. So somebody had gotten the PowerPoint to one of the staff members, but she was still asking, well, where's the report?
I don't
saying,
call that
oh,
into
we'll
question.
Give it to you later.
No, you're 100% correct. And I suppose one point of difference here is I don't think it mattered what was in this report. They had already decided what they were going to do. They were just looking for something to point to.
I think you're right. But Jason, the reason why I wrote the story and put myself in a position to be attacked and get all this headache is because that number of $400 million flew around the country like wildfire.
Mm-hmm.
And there wasn't any way that I or anybody else could get a hold of the, quote, report. And so when we went in and said, where did this $400 million number come from? Where's the report? All over the place, people were, and then I finally found out, all there is a PowerPoint, a briefing document. I said, really? So I understand that the supporters of the tax are angry at me, they can still support the tax. They can still say it's $400 million if they want. But the fact is that it's irresponsible to both cite a report that say, I have a report that says it's $400 million and there isn't. There's a PowerPoint that doesn't say that. Then to actually report in headlines, McKinsey says $400 million in a report. And it's like, where's the report? I can't see it. It's not linked in and Crosscut. It wasn't linked in the blog post that McKinsey put up. So the process foul here, Jason, is that when you introduce that kind of number the day before a vote or on the dais when you're making the vote and say there is a study by a very well-respected firm that says we should spend $400 million a year, people should be able to see that report.
I agree.
And look at it. And they didn't do that.
I totally agree. But if that was the main focus of your article, and that was, or even just exclusively, that's what your complaint was, we wouldn't be having this conversation. I wouldn't have reported on anything.
Jason,
I've read the article.
It draws the distinction between the PowerPoint and the report.
However, the big point, which you bolded and underlined, I believe, in the article, was there never was a report. City leaders reciting a report that never existed. That makes a bold claim, and I think that it's factually inaccurate. The rest of the article, I don't particularly take issue with. You and I completely share the same concern over how this was handled, how disingenuous the council's being, how they're keeping stuff away from us because they know that we would actually take a deeper dive into the numbers and call them out. I take no issue whatsoever. My concern here, however, is you've given them a win by making them seem like actual victims by taking something and reporting it inaccurately. And now they're going to use that against you, against me, against all of us who actually want a referendum on this head tax, and they're going to try to play victim. And that bothers me because they're not victims. They're the one. Seattle is a victim of their policies, and we've given them a little bit, and they're going to exploit that, and they're going to use that to attack us. And I'll let you have the last word.
I take your point on that, Jason, but I would say to you that if you read the article and the timeline that I put up, I think that people can judge for themselves whether the PowerPoint is really a report or whether it's just a briefing document. And I think that's up to people to decide. But we couldn't make that decision because we didn't have anything to look at. So if it's a semantic point, then I concede that. But the reality is, functionally, there was no report, and I stick to that.
The article I've got right now, it's linked up at KTTH.com. It's also at Forbes. Both articles, he's got also an update from the article that was originally written on Wednesday. Go to KTTH.com or, of course, at Forbes.com. I've been talking, again, with the director of Seattle for Growth. His name is Roger Valdez. He's still a friend of the show. We have a disagreement on a factual point in his article, but otherwise we're on the exact same page. And I appreciate your willingness to come on the show. Lorena Gonzalez can't say the same for her because she runs from any invite, apparently, that we offer. It always gets turned down. But you actually decided to come on. And full disclosure to everyone, we tried to have him on Thursday, yesterday, but he wasn't able to. So it wasn't because we were holding back. He didn't demand to be on the show. We wanted to get together and actually have this conversation because ultimately, we believe in the same things. We just have a small point of disagreement. Roger, I appreciate you coming on. I appreciate you sharing your reasoning behind your article and giving us your side.
We'll always do that. Thank you very much, Jason.
Absolutely. Welcome back to the Jason Rancher live in the Online Training Academy studio on this Friday morning. Shama Sawant and the Seattle LGBTQ Commission hosted an anti-Semitic event in Seattle last night. An event that promoted anti-Israel stereotypes, sided with people who want to wipe Israel off the face of this earth, but it's okay because they personally don't think what they did was wrong. Okay. Got it. Thanks. It's kind of weird because I'm looking at their Facebook event page for this anti-Semitic event, and they clearly take positions that are anti-Israel. The page claimed, quote, Israel is the country most famous for pinkwashing, and argues they engage in apartheid, a term these people don't actually understand. They don't share blame for anything that they think is going on in the region. They exclusively say Israel is to blame. They're not asking whether or not the claims that they just made are true. They're presenting them as fact. This is their way of siding against Israel, defending itself against Hamas, a terrorist organization which purposefully puts civilians in harm's way in an effort to create anti-Israel propaganda that then Shama Sawan ends up regurgitating. This is Jew hating at its worst, at its most destructive. This is the actual textbook definition of anti-Semitism. Now, Sawant is no stranger to any of this because I had her on my show a few years ago where she refused to acknowledge Hamas as a terrorist organization. She put out a statement yesterday saying the video, the screening of a propaganda documentary, oh, there's no bias there. It's all good. It's cool. The film they screened last night, it's a documentary called Pinkwashing Exposed, Seattle Fights Back, Pinkwashing. This is a term that's used against Israel, claiming they promote itself as gay-friendly in order to hide their supposed terrible human rights violations. That's a quote from the event page, which is kind of a weird and ironic claim for them to make because they're promoting LGBTQ solidarity in an effort to hide their virulent anti-Semitism. Now, in the opening moments of the film, and it's online, I don't recommend you watch it because it's a propaganda piece, and I saw clips last night. It was driving me insane. But they open up with a woman named Nada Elia. She's an activist who's wearing a sweater that says, Palestine, we will return. This is what she says.
Israel is not a gay-friendly country. Israel is gay-friendly when it serves its purposes.
Homosexuality is illegal in Palestine. If she went to the border where the protests erupted a week and a half ago, and she brought a same-sex partner, and she dared to kiss that same-sex partner, she would be killed on the spot. She's dealing with terrorists that she's now siding with. She has called for an intifada against Israel. She's defended a young terrorist who tried to become a martyr while stabbing to death Israelis. She pushes anti-Israeli conspiracy theories, yet the commission on their event page claims to, quote, unequivocally condemn anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish behavior, which is funny because the event and the movie that they screened is the actual physical manifestation of anti-Semitism. Now, the Jewish community in Seattle has spoken out. They've complained. The commission kind of dismisses them by tokenizing the, quote, Jewish filmmaker who directed this movie and claims that the film, quote, features Jewish and Palestinian activists working together, except the documentary provides only one perspective. The Jews and the Palestinians who are working together using anti-Semitic tropes. The director holds extreme views, is virulently anti-Israel. They did not present a second side. They didn't present another side on the panel that happened afterwards. They didn't show another film that gave you just a little bit of a look from the Israeli perspective. They simply chose to go with an extreme anti-Semitic perspective, which is why the Jewish Federation of Seattle has spoken out. They wrote online, this event is veiled as focusing on LGBTQ rights while it actually promotes lies about Israel, alienates and discriminates against the tens of thousands of Jews and Israelis living there, and is likely at the very least to stir up increased anti-Semitism. This is a gross misuse of public dollars and is unacceptable. And here's the thing, they're not alone. And it's not just Jewish organizations that are coming out. In fact, Mayor Jenny Durkan has slammed the event. And I give her kudos, because even though I disagree with her politically on most of her positions, kudos to her for putting out a statement from her office saying the mayor disagrees with the viewpoints in this film, believes it's regrettable that it is perceived as having the official approval of the city of Seattle. At a time with increased anti-Semitism in Seattle and across the country, Mayor Durkan thinks our community should be focused on coming together to stand against hatred. In response, Mayor Durkan has asked the Office for Civil Rights to host an event in the upcoming weeks to further promote dialogue around anti-Semitism, both here and abroad. Now, as a Jew, I'm personally disgusted by this. In fact, last night I sent an email to the LGBTQ commission because they interviewed me about a month ago to become a commissioner. And my thought at the time was, okay, these are crazy people. These are crazy people. And my intent, if I were to be on this commission, is to purposefully present a different opinion, an opinion that they protect themselves from hearing. But last night I sent them an email saying, yeah, do not consider me for a role within this commission. I want nothing to do with an anti-Semitic organization. And that's what the LGBTQ commission is right now. They've come out very clearly as being anti-Israel and anti-Semitic. And yes, You can criticize Israel without being called an anti-Semitic person, right? An anti-Semite. But you know what? You might just be an anti-Semite if you play into stereotypes to attack Israel, if you only, exclusively attack Israel, and if you side with a group of people who are terrorists like Hamas. You wonder why there was, from 2016 to 2017, a 60% rise in anti-Semitic attacks in this country? It's because of events like this. Shame on them. Shame on them. I've got the story coming up shortly at KTTH.com.